You unlock this door with a key of imagination. Beyond it, another dimension, a dimension of sight, a dimension of mind, and most importantly, a dimension of sound. You've just crossed over into the Grateful Dead Zone. Greetings, cats and kittens, foxes and coyotes. This is indeed a special edition of the Grateful Dead Zone. We're going to depart from our format slightly. We're still going to loosely get a first and a second set, but not really. But we're going to be joined by, and in fact are joined by, Brian Anderson, who wrote a fantastic book on the wall of sound called Loud and Clear. And Brian, are you there?
I am here.
Hey,
how are you?
I'm great. Where are you hailing from at this present moment in time?
Chicago, Illinois, USA, planet Earth.
Planet Earth. Well, congratulations. So don't worry. You can be prideful here. You told me earlier your book hit the
thank you.
A lot of deadheads out there. The New York Times bestseller list. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, I mean, big built-in audience, right? But no, thank you so much. It's very surreal.
Yeah, well, speaking of surreal, why don't we start with some appropriate background music to get us going here. So, Brian, what are we listening to there?
Well, we are listening to Feedback from June 14th, 1968 at the Fillmore East in New York City, New York. And opening a gig with Feedback, very, very bold choice here.
And the book, let's just say, you know, there's so much to cover, but I'm going to try to tell you what I loved about the book. And there's been a lot of books on the Grateful Dead, on the Grateful Dead. But you chose a filter that I'd never seen before or read about before or really contemplating, and that's the history of the Grateful Dead through their respective sound systems. This book, folks, isn't just about the wall of sound in 74. It basically starts at the very beginning, Magoo's Pizza Parlor, if I'm remembering correctly, in Menlo Park, just over the hill, and describes the Dead's quest for sound and how their quest for sonic perfection in their shows was equal to their quest for musical perfection, and how they complemented one another, and how they kind of, the whole thing about the Grateful Dead extending the vibe and the immersiveness of the acid test kept going all the way to the end and is still going on at the Sphere in Las Vegas.
Right.
And is that a fair assessment of the book? I mean, again, I'm trying to reduce this down to listeners who I'm going to make sure get the book, but that's what I saw. That's what I saw going on, and it was unique.
Absolutely, yes. You know, to your point, there's been so many books that have been written about the Grateful Dead over the years, and there's so much amazing scholarship out there, and all of that speaks to the ongoing phenomena, right? But I knew that if I was going to do this story, I had to really start at the very beginning of the band. So, you know, 64, Warlocks era, 65, because that's really when the story gets going. And a main point that I try to illuminate in the book is that the wall of sound as we know it today did not just fall from the clear blue sky one day, fully formed in 1974. You know, that was the culmination of a years-long progression that started at the very beginning of the band. So with the book, I knew that I had to sort of, you know, track the evolution of the Dead sound system through these various iterations over the years, beginning in 65 through the end of 1974, as they were, you know, figuring things out and really just building this amazing piece of groundbreaking technology from scratch completely. So I think your assessment is right on point. And so, you know, I knew that this book couldn't just be about the 40 shows that the Dead played in 1974. Of course, that's kind of a peak of the book, but there was so much work that happened before then that I knew I really had to dig into and cover.
Well, what again, as a debt historian, you know, an amateur debt historian, not a New York Times best-selling author debt historian. Again, congratulations to you for that.
No, thank you.
It's the confluence of personalities. When you think of these sort of giants of a American revolution, and I'm thinking Ken Kesey, Jerry Garcia, and Phil Lesh, and the unsung hero, I think, of your book, Owsley Stanley.
For sure.
That they all come together and that they all complemented each other. You have Kesey getting the acid test together and having this idea of using LSD to as a religious drug to it opens door the doors of perception. Then you have Owsley, absolutely on the spectrum beyond a genius, who's not only synthesizing the sacramental LSD, he's obsessed with putting the money that he made selling LSD into the Grateful Dead sound system and making them sound as good as humanly possible, which carries all the way, as far as I'm concerned, into the sphere today.
And for sure,
without Kesey, or without Garcia, or without Lesh, or without Owsley, this doesn't happen, you know. And it's the combination of all. I mean, again, I'm throwing out these concepts to you. I'm just curious what you think.
Yeah. I mean, The Wall of Sound, it took a whole cast of characters to actualize and construct this thing. And, you know, I try to give space and to center all of these characters in the book. And that's partly why, you know, if you pick up the book at the very beginning, I have a list of all the characters, almost like, you know, when you go to see a play or a musical, you know, there's sort of a breakout of, you know, all the characters kind of right at the beginning of the program. Or if you read an oral history, you know, quite often you get all of the characters and sort of, you know, a bit of a description of who they are. So there's so many characters in these books, obviously, like, you know, the Keseys, the Owsleys, the Garcias, the Leshes, of course, who were so instrumental. But there's all these other kind of secondary characters.
Alembic.
Too.
Yeah,
so,
you know, the sound guys, the roadies. Yeah, these.
Right, exactly.
Well, American geniuses, you know, the level, the aggregate IQ of the Grateful Dead's brain trust and the people they attracted is off the charts, you know.
Right.
And you have the moon, you know, you have NASA in the same period of time figuring out how to get a man on the moon so Alan Shepard can hit a golf ball there. And then have this group creating sound and this music simultaneously. And in the course of this next, in this Dead Zone, we're going to kind of go chronologically and talk, Brian, with you about, you know, the music you've chosen and why you've chosen it. But I wanted to start at the end, and this would be the opening song, be Philadelphia, August 5th, 1974. And as you mentioned, there were only 40 shows with the Wall of Sound. And I got to see one of them at Winterland in October of 74. My colleague and occasional co-host Henry Kaiser saw it a couple of times, and as a musician and a guy who knows his sound, said he has never heard anything sound better. And this is a guy who's worked in front of a lot of equipment in the last 50 years since then. So we're going to hear the Wall of Sound in action. This is the Grateful Dead Zone. I'm on with Brian Anderson, the New York Times best-selling author. You see, you never should have put this idea in my mind. I'm going to keep saying it. Because to me, it's validation for all of us. You know, we are legion. We are a legion, Brian. But the book, The Grateful Dead, Wall of Sound, The Quest for Audio Perfection, Loud and Clear. But let's go to the boys. This is The Boys and One Girl, August 5th, 1974.
Hello, man. Across the Rio Grande, across
The wall of sound cranked up. This is, boy, that's a tasty bit of music. So looking at the back cover of your book, Brian Anderson, author of Loud and Clear, The Grateful Dead, Wall of Sound, and The Quest for Audio Perfection, if you're just tuning in, I notice, I notice your picture. You're a youngin'. When did you first see The Grateful Dead?
Yeah. So for context, I just recently turned 39 years old. So I was born in 1986. I first saw The Grateful Dead in 1989 as a toddler. I was 3 years old, and my folks brought my sister and I up to Alpine Valley in Wisconsin, hallowed 80s era dead ground, right?
Yeah.
Amazing shows up there. So really my earliest flashes of memory, real core memories, are watching the Dead perform.
And your parents, you're a second generation Deadhead. They were hard, not just unofficial Deadheads. Your mom baked cookies backstage. I mean, give me a little bit on your parents, because that part,
that's
one of
right.
the wonderful things in the book isn't just a dry recitation of facts about the Wall of Sound. There's a precious few of those, but just your personal story fascinates me.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I learned so much from my parents, just absorbing Dead knowledge through them. And yeah, in short, you know, you'll meet them in the book, but they were orbiting each other and the band beginning in the early 70s. My dad first started seeing the Dead here in Chicago, just on the street, actually, at the old Kinetic Playground in 1969. And my mother, in the early 70s, when she was still a teenager, she got hooked up with a big East Coast rock and roll promoter at the time, Howard Stein, who had a burgeoning Midwest concert operation. So through a connection of hers at a local record store here in town, she would work sort of day of production odd jobs at not only Grateful Dead shows, but, you know, every other band going back then, Black Sabbath, The Who, King Crimson, Hawkwind, go down the list. So she was around at, you know, sort of proto Wall of Sound shows and also Wall of Sound proper shows, working those shows backstage and then other shows sort of around as like a guest of the band. She would also bake goods for the band. So that's a reputation that earned her the nickname Cookie Lady. And at the same time, my father was going to see the band, but he was out in the audience, right? So, you know, he was seeing those same proto Wall of Sound shows, and it was only later where they would sort of, you know, actually meet each other. So they were kind of crossing, or rather, you know, passing each other like ships in the night. Well, in that era.
With all due respect, I think the theory that LSD causes genetic mutation may have resulted in this book. I'm just pointing this out here. You know, you're
sure.
Obviously, you know, you're among your other, you're a science editor at Atlantic, part of the Pulitzer winning prize team for the pandemic coverage. You teach journalism at Northwestern University, yet you're a rabid Deadhead, in essence, carrying the work of Owsley forward and documenting it. So just saying, there's some legacy, there's a hangover there, and that's like an excellent thing.
It's a huge story, and you know, I wanted to do it justice and do it right. And I should also, you know, shout out my dad quickly too. In the 80s, he got hooked up with the Grateful Dead's Midwest local crew, so he did stagehand work. So that's why, you know, my folks would bring my sister and I up to shows at Alpine Valley when he was working those shows at the time. I mean, this stuff, it goes so deep, you know, and I've been fascinated with it my entire life. So I kind of feel like I've been building up to this book since really the very beginning. You know, people ask me like, how long have you been working on this? And I'm like,
since
I was 3 years old. Here we are, and it's a couple weeks out, and it's incredible.
Well, in that process of evolution, let's get, you know, back to the, you know, topic at hand. You know, the Dead, the Dead always wanted to sound as good as they could, always.
Oh, yeah.
Always. Even in Magoo's Pizza Parlor, they got top of the line, whatever they could afford. Owsley brings them down to L.A. in, what, 66? That was all that was in the fridge was meat. And they were woodshedding and practicing, and Owsley was doing all sorts of interesting things. And one thing about Owsley, again, with this confluence, was Owsley knew how important this was. He knew how great the music was,
yeah.
And he recorded everything. There would not be a Grateful Dead culture, I believe, were it not for the existence of the tapes and how much of the Dead's was captured. There'd be fanatics,
totally.
But there wouldn't be this unbelievable... I've done now, I think, 230 Grateful Dead Zones, 232-hour
wow.
shows across the
Amazing.
Last 4 or 5 years. I have yet to play a single performance twice.
Right.
Think about that. And in my lossless Dead stuff, like officially released lossless stuff, I still have 7,000 performances left to go from. And
wow. Yeah.
That shows how much is out there. And yes,
am
I out of my mind? Absolutely. But we wouldn't have any of this if Owsley hadn't said, I'm going to tape it and then pass the tradition down to Kid and the other
sure.
Betty, all the people who were recording the shows, Dan, they always knew they got to capture this and keep it. But
oh, yeah.
The evolution, though, you know, goes from, you know, they kept sounding better and better. And then the next thing we're going to play that is a request of yours is a track from Live Dead. Why
yes.
is Live Dead important in the Grateful Dead sound chronology?
Sure. I mean, it sort of set the blueprint for a live recording. To your point, the Dead had been recording their shows really since, you know, the very beginning when they got going. But I think it came to a culmination with Live Dead. Just the way that they recorded those shows. And, you know, I have to shout out Betty Jackson, obviously, and Bob Matthews and Ron Wickersham, who developed a microphone splitter technology to sort of help record those shows. But no one had really captured a performance like that. And even the way that record was mixed too, sort of the idea was to mix it from like the perspective of the audience, not necessarily from like the perspective of the stage. So you listen to Live Dead and it's like it transports you right back. Like you're kind of you're right in the soup there. Like you're right in the thick of it, with all of those who were witnessing those shows. And also, you know, Live Dead, just the performances of those songs that are on that record are, you know, still canonical. I mean,
it's true.
It's got arguably one of the greatest Dark Stars.
Exactly.
Ever, right?
You know, how many Dark yeah. Stars were there? The one they picked of the batch is still one of the top three Dark Stars. I don't think there's a
For sure.
who wouldn't argue
right.
that point.
Right.
They picked
right.
it right. I mean, everything right. came together on this record. Well, that was the
right.
lecture. This will be the lab. We're going to go back to the Avalon Ballroom right now, January 26, 1969. This is the Grateful Dead Zone on KSQD. This is Eric Nelson with Brian Anderson. We're dissecting the long, strange trip that led to the Mammoth Wall of Sound in 1974, semi-chronologically, but let's go down to the Avalon Ballroom and hear just how primal the Grateful Dead can get.
KSQD thanks Santa Cruz Shakespeare for their support. Santa Cruz Shakespeare's festival runs July through September with productions of Into the Woods, A Midsummer Night's Dream, Pericles, and Master Harold and the Boys. Performances are outdoors in the Audrey Stanley Grove in Santa Cruz's De La Viega Park. Tickets at santacruzshakespeare.org. Thank you, Santa Cruz Shakespeare, for supporting community radio K-Squid.
Primal, Grateful Dead.
Oh, yeah.
And you're right that these were pretty much the definitive performances. And it's easy to forget. Had anyone put a 16-track recorder and recorded a live concert before the Dead did this? If I would be hard-pressed to imagine anybody who got there before them.
No. Yeah, they were the first. That's another thing. There's so many. The Dead notched so many sort of sonic firsts along the way as they were building up to the Wall of Sound, right? It's just staggering, the ground that they were breaking. But yeah, you put it exactly right. Like Live Dead is just the culmination of this primal era, right? Like in which all of the musicians were kind of folding and feeding back into one another, producing this like filthy fury of raging and whirling psychedelic soundscapes, And so to me, it doesn't get more primal than like a 1969-11, right?
Yeah.
So and amazing stuff.
And Phil Lesh, too. I mean, we mentioned it earlier, which is the collective IQ of the core four, not the entire band. But when you have, Jerry met Phil Lesh and knew just instantly that Lesh would be the bass player, even though Phil had never touched that instrument before.
Yeah.
And I think it was Lesh's brilliance that Garcia, another autodidact genius, instantly saw. And it's probably what Ken Kesey saw. I mean, Kesey was a legitimate academic, best-selling author, not unlike Brian Anderson, whose book is now on the bestseller list. So you're following in the fine traditions of Ken Kesey in all these fundamental ways here. But
oh boy.
But they and then Owsley's off the charts smart. And the thing about the Dead that when I dive deep into history, and what I loved about your book was it just opened up, connections I hadn't seen before, was just how hard they worked. The Dead.
Oh, yeah.
The Dead never took themselves seriously because at heart they were beatnik hippies, but they took their work incredibly seriously. They did mess around, and the amount of work that went into every show, making sure the sound was good, the infrastructure they created and assembled and oversaw to keep their show on the road, the amount of time they spent in rehearsals and the amount of time they played. In some ways, if you think about it, you have these extraordinary individuals, this moment in time, the right drugs, this musical genius, the technology coming together. It's like, of course the Grateful Dead, we're talking about them, what, 70 years later about their music.
Right.
This is the 70th anniversary of their first show in December, not too far away from me in San Jose. So, and you capture that, I think. You capture the in a very concise way by the sound system. Just a kind of a dumb generic question, what surprised you? What did you learn doing the book that you didn't really know?
Sure. Yeah. Oh boy. I mean, there's so many little nuggets that I picked up along the way, just reporting the book, speaking with folks who were, in the room, sort of at the table at this signal moment, who had never really given any interviews and opened up to me, and they gave me just so much like wonderful material. I think one thing that did sort of surprise me is that once, the 70s were underway, and this next track here, we're going to sort of turn to the 70s. But once the 70s were underway, just the lengths the Dead went to prepare for tours and to, really like pioneer the art of advancing a tour, by which I mean they would send ahead, there were various folks in the crew who would go check out venues
ahead of time. Right.
Ahead of time, right. And, you know, no one was doing that. And, you know, they would send an advance team out to check out the space wherever they were going to be playing. Even, you know, take some acoustic readings, right, to get just a sense of what they were going to be working with. And, you know, at the time they were, you know, when they were kind of leveling up, they were playing, you know, starting to play, you know, college gymnasiums, skating rinks, right? So spaces that are very acoustically difficult to tame. So, you know, they would send these advanced teams out to gather information and then come and report back so that they could really kind of be prepared when they would roll into wherever it happened to be, right? So I think, you know, getting sort of a sense of how the advancing worked was really sort of neat and surprised me. Just like the attention to detail that would go on during the advancing of those tours was pretty amazing. And then, you know, once the full wall was sort of scaled up, you know, I had no idea that, you know, Dan Healy, for instance, had like 1/10 scale models, you know, kind of like these like Lego type sets that he could, you know, based on the information that was coming back from the advance crews, he could set up these little models to sort of get a sense of how the rig would be configured at any of these venues that they'd be rolling into. So yeah, a lot of that advance work was like really sort of maybe not necessarily totally surprising because I knew that they did some of that stuff, but it was very cool to kind of, you know, dig into just sort of the pre-production, I guess.
Again, how hard, you know, getting it, quote, just exactly perfect.
Exactly.
If you look at the history of the Dead comments on stage to the audience, almost 90% of it is them griping about or explaining why there's delays in the sound system or yelling at Bear to turn something up properly. And, you know, again, they were very attentive. So speaking of weird venues, this is you chose this from the Golden Hall Community Concourse. I don't have the city there, but
that's right. San Diego. Yeah.
And interesting now, this is 1970. The last half of 1970, all of a sudden we lose tapes. We lose soundboards. Why do we lose soundboards? And why does that relate to San Diego, Brian Anderson?
It's a good question. Owsley was beginning to sort of be in and out of the picture due to his legal troubles.
You're being euphemistic. He was in the Slammer in Terminal Island.
He was in Terminal Island.
He was in the Grey Bar Motel there at that time.
Yes. Where, as I talk about in the book, a year later in 1971, the Dead would perform a private show for Owsley at Terminal Island. An amazing little piece of history, that show. But yeah, Owsley was out of the picture due to his legal troubles. And, you know, one other thing that I sort of, you know, got an appreciation for working on the book is that, you know, crew members who were recording shows. So, you know, Kid Candelario, Rex Jackson, Betty, you know, they were doing any number of things during a show. So at times they would be lucky if they were, you know, not off fixing something, some bit of gear, and they were able to flip the tape in time, you know, and capture like a full performance. So that, you know, there are even tapes of some of these shows in the latter half of 70. I think, you know, even if they're partial or not soundboards, my opinion is that like any Grateful Dead recording that we have today is it's a gift. It's truly a gift that this stuff exists. And I love here, like, you know, 69, we just heard like peak primal Dead, and here we turn to 70. And
well, let's surprise this, people. They come out and they do this. And
so you've let's heard, hear it. Yeah,
you've heard Primal Dead. You've heard that 11. Now we're going to hear what?
Right.
Thank you.
A small but determined crowd there. Yeah, imagine people going to expect Primal Dead and they get an acoustic set, right, Brian?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, that gig is just the embodiment of dusty, sort of Bakersfield, countrified Americana.
Well, think about dead. Think about the sets in that particular period. So you'd get an acoustic, you'd get, first off, you'd get a New Rider set with Jerry playing brilliant pedal steel. He may not have had the technical chops, but he knew every note counted and played every note exactly right. Then you'd get an acoustic set. Then you'd get a first set, and then you'd get a second set. So you'd, in essence, Garcia would be literally on stage 5 hours, not just taking intermissions, on stage with an instrument in his hand for 5 hours in that period of time. There's a great story where somebody heckled during one of these shows. Somebody was yelling out boogie or something, you know, wanting to hear them rock during an acoustic set. And Garcia said, you know, this is the part where you listen loud and we play soft.
That's right. And, I love that.
That really, you know, that kind of captures what he was about at that particular time. You're listening to the Grateful Dead Zone with Eric Nelson and special guest, unindicted co-conspirator Brian Anderson, is author of The Grateful Dead's Wall of Sound and The Quest for Audio Perfection, a loud and clear, a book that, shockingly, did you think this thing was going to hit the New York Times bestseller list? Come on, honestly.
I knew it had legs. I knew people would be very into this book. But yeah, getting the news from my editor, I was like, this is just, it's hard to even wrap my head around and to begin to process that. But it's super validating. And like, you know, you said at the top of the show, like, this is for all of us, you know? So it means so much that, you know, it would crack that sort of list, right? You know, it's just, it's very surreal.
Well, again, it's a sociological history of the Grateful Dead and personality-driven and anecdotally driven. You know, there's a lot of Grateful Dead books out there. You know, McNally's book, Dennis McNally's book's terrific.
Sure.
The oral history's good, Selvin and Gans, you know.
Yep.
There's been a lot of great books on the Grateful Dead. You remember Michael Lydon's article about the Portland gig in 69 in Rolling Stone, which is one of the best on, you know, so a lot of great writing on the Dead. But this book holds up not just writing-wise, it holds up because of the filter you set. And if you're just tuning in, the filter is the evolution of the Grateful Dead and their music through the evolution of their sound system that culminates in the Wall of Sound. This doesn't a book about the Wall of Sound. The Wall of Sound is, what, last 50 pages or something? The book kind of traces it out. And the Dead were slowly building the wall. It's unfortunate that the phrase build the wall has taken on a more malign connotation in the last few years. But the Dead built the right wall, and they built it slowly, and they built it right. Well, you picked, I'm going to go to the Auditorium Theater, I think in Chicago, August 23rd.
Oh, yeah.
You picked this particular song. We're in 1981 now. We're going forward now in the Wayback Machine. Year forward from San Diego. August 5th, 70, if you're keeping score at home. Now we're at the Auditorium Theater. Why did you pick this particular song?
Well, you know, I'm a Chicago guy, right? So, you know, I had to get a cut in from the Auditorium Theater, which, you know, hallowed Dead ground. And this show in particular, August 23rd, 71, was the first time the Dead ever performed at the Auditorium, at which they'd go on to do shows on and off through 1977. And the late Mark Sparky Rosine, one of the Dead roadies, he told me, he's a Chicago guy himself. Sadly, he passed away at the beginning of this year, but he told me the Auditorium sounded so damn good. And loading in was kind of a nightmare because it was down this back alley to the stage entrance, and we weren't using the big trucks yet. They were using, you know, smaller kind of box trucks. But I picked Birdsong because, you know, for one, it's probably one of my favorite tracks. But here, I think it's so sort of classic 71, where, you know, you're getting some big jams in 71. But like, this is a pretty sort of a concise Birdsong. And I think, you know, at the time, the Dead were using this sort of tie-dye rig with, you know, kind of these colorful mandala speaker covers, right? To sort of add color and form to the sound waves that were flowing out of the dead PA, right? And I think you hear that in this bird song here, just kind of classic, like, you know, single drummer dead. You know, I think a perfect fusion of, like, you know, sort of that stripped down turn that they took in 70, but also sort of, you know, teasing out some of the kind of like acid jazz that they would move into in like 72, 73. So just a great performance here.
La 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 la. See me. like a bird within her sail.
Hi, I'm Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead. Public and community radio were very important to our early development. They continue to be a source of inspiration and information. They also serve as an important vehicle for many of our pet projects. I subscribe. I urge you to pledge your support. Thank you.
KSQD Santa Cruz 90.7 FM, KSQT Prunedale 89.7 FM, and Translator K208GE Monterey 89.5 FM.
You may have a nice speech and everything, man. When we go someplace, yeah, we come for one reason. And that reason is to rock.
A rock and blast from the past, Wednesday afternoons from 1 to 3 p.m. Relics and Psychedelics, only here on The Squid, KSQD Santa Cruz.
I'm doing my part, Daddy.
And we're doing our part, Daddy. So, Brian, I always love to play that particular promo after a bird song. Why do I like to play that? He asked rhetorically.
How come?
Oh, you don't know? That was a bird song was written for Janis Joplin.
Oh, sure. Of course. Yeah.
See, that was such an obvious one. You thought it was – I had to have several layers of trivia.
I thought there was like –
I couldn't possibly ask a simple question. You'd have to be a stump the deadhead, which we – our can on this show, we gave away some good goodies. That's the 3-CD boil down of the 60-CD latest Rhino amazing thing. And the question was – we didn't just talk about the ESP experiment at the Capitol Theater. The question was, what were the names of the two people on the receiving end in the experimental labs? And someone called in within 40 seconds. It was a little frightening.
Yeah.
It was a little frightening, the well of dead trivia. So this is a special Grateful Dead Zone. We're speaking with Brian Anderson, author of the book, and the title kind of says it all. I'll go first, Loud and Clear: The Grateful Dead's Wall of Sound and the Quest for Audio Perfection. Or you could read it, The Grateful Dead's Wall of Sound and the Quest for Audio Perfection, loud and clear. Either way works for me. A recent and brand new New York Times bestseller, and we're unpacking all things Grateful Dead sound system. Now, something from the book that I really found fascinating, because I'm a bit of an Owsley thing. Steve Silberman, the great Steve Silberman, who I had the privilege, he joined me once for a special on David Crosby, David Crosby's passing. And who knew that Steve Silberman would be joining Crosby in the celestial Fillmore afterwards.
Yeah.
But he made a pretty strong case, and Silberman knows that Owsley was in the spectrum and had what he calls a synesthesia. Can you tell me? What's that, and how does that relate to Owsley?
Yeah, so synesthesia.
There you go.
Synesthesia. It's a sort of tongue twister. Synesthesia is, certain individuals out there experience synesthesia. Phil Lesh notably experienced synesthesia. And this is when you experience one sense through another. So Owsley, he sort of quote unquote saw sound as color. And there's a couple of very crucial moments in early 1966 when the Dead were down in Los Angeles for a couple months, when Owsley was sitting around watching the band rehearse or perform around town. And at the time they were using his home hi-fi stereo system. He basically just gave them his rig and was like, this is your new sound system. But he would be sitting around, cranked on his own supply of high-powered LSD, and he would see the Dead sound flowing from their speakers as emanating waves of color. And he was very moved by this, and he thought to himself, I need to remember how this feels. And, you look at the development over the next couple of years, peaking with the Wall of Sound. The Wall of Sound is really a means through which Owsley could sort of like conjure that sensation out in the crowd, right? So synesthesia, folks on the spectrum, it's overrepresented on the spectrum, the synesthesia. But Owsley as well was very bothered by unclean signals, so distortion. And Silberman was talking with me about this. And so this goes back to Owsley from the very beginning, setting them on this quest to achieve the most pure signal, right? And that would, again, culminate with the Wall of Sound, this distortion-free, massive hi-fi system, right? So there were a couple other folks in the Dead scene who also had this similar sort of synesthesia, where they could sort of see sound as color or symbols almost.
And Owsley thought, and there aren't many people who could argue with him, he could talk to the electronics. Explain that concept to me.
Yes, so Owsley would form really intense attachments with non-human entities or inanimate equipment, right? So there's all these stories about, folks who would stumble upon Owsley backstage somewhere in a quiet moment, hugging an amplifier or a speaker cabinet and, sobbing and talking in hushed tones to this piece of gear, like trying to coax something out of it, right? So you also see that too on the spectrum. Folks sort of form attachments with non-human entities because, they can sort of rely on those sorts of relationships. But yeah, you have these moments where Owsley would be like, folks would overhear him talking to a piece of gear being like, how could you let me down? I need you to like perform right now.
The thing that a lot of these people say, and it would work.
And it would work. Yeah, would anthropomorphize the gear. Yeah,
and the gear would respond accordingly. Let's go to the Berklee Community Theater. To place this in time, folks, this is 6 days before Vanita. So the famous Creamery benefit, it's on the top five of Grateful Dead, famous shows, whether it's the best show of all time, I don't know about that. But they played a legendary show in 6 days, and I think they had a four-night stand at the Berklee Community Theater just across the bay. And you chose this, Brian Anderson, so why don't you tee this, these next two numbers up.
Yes, so this is a China Rider from it was the first of a three-night run at the community theater in Berkeley. And yeah, you can, you know, by this point, 72, you can hear the sound getting clearer and clearer, right? Like as the Dead's iterations of their sound system were morphing and pieces of the wall of sound were starting to click into place. You know, they're hot off Europe 72, so they're just really firing on all cylinders. And, you know, like you said, this is just a couple days before Vanita, which I think just would have been too on the nose to pick Vanita. But no, this is just like sort of, to me, like a canonical China Rider recorded by Betty. Shout out, Betty. And it's just a wonderful piece of music here.
Thank you. KSQD thanks the Santa Cruz Baroque Festival for its support. The Baroque Festival presents its annual fundraiser, Boomeria, Saturday, July 12th, from 1 to 5 p.m. under the Redwoods in Ben Lomond at St. Andrew's Episcopal Church. Boomeria includes food, wine, and performances on the chapel, pipe organ, and the church grounds with local musicians and festival artistic director Jörg Redden. Tickets and information at scbaroque.org or 831-457-9693.
You were right, Brian Anderson, about that China Rider. Just not only exquisite performance, but exquisitely recorded. You hear every single instrument.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, by this point, too, 72, getting into 73, the Dead had firmly entered the Alembic PA era. So Alembic, the custom instrument and electronics company, which is still around today, right? But who were very intertwined with the Dead from the company's founding in 1969, had started to build essentially a for-rent sound system. And by the end of 72, getting into 70, or excuse me, the end of 71, getting into 72, the Dead realized, you know what, let's just purchase the Alembic PA and take it out on the road with us. So that's the sound system that, you know, you just heard here from the Berklee Community Theater. And that's the sound system that would also really start to
mutate, morph, and mutate
into what we know as the Wall of Sound.
Well, interesting stats in your book. And you say in 72, the Dead grossed $1.4 million, which would be, folks, $10 million today. But this is the interesting thing, and it's, of course, there's a direct line here, I think, between the golden era of this other company, that in essence, 9/10 of the Dead's income went to R&D sound systems, almost enough to band salaries, which is right. Not a statistic also shared by Apple, founded, and certainly the driving force, another well-known acid head, Steve Jobs, who put the money back on the screen. So basically 18%. You know, these are interesting stats. It wasn't about the money. And Dennis McNally said, the point was this holy grail. God knows Jerry talked about it. They all talked about it, of making the sound as good as humanly possible. So,
yeah.
Well, let's go to Lincoln, Nebraska. Let's get into 1973 here. This is the proto wall of wall. They started, wasn't 223 at Stanford, the first concert that really brought out the new system, the new souped-up system?
It was Stanford. It was February 9th, 73.
Okay, so then that would be...
Yes, yeah, so...
So then right. Like 3 weeks later, they've taken this thing, and now it's in Nebraska. And this would be the Alembic, this is our sound system, it's great, and we're going to take it wherever we go, correct?
Exactly right, yep.
So do you want to say anything about this next performance, or just do we just go into it?
Yeah, I think I'll sort of set this up by saying that I love how the Dead took this new sound system out on the road. Really, the first proper tour dates with this sound system were in the frozen upper Midwest. That's like the ultimate proving grounds. So I just love that. They're like, nope, we're going to take it to...
Yeah. Repeat. Lincoln, Nebraska, February 26th. You guys do the weather.
Exactly, yes. Right. So if we can make it work there, we can make it work anywhere, right? I could pay you back with
find another on this trail.
This time.
Good choice, Brian Anderson. I had not heard that till this particular second. I try not to play them in advance so I can...
Sure.
Wow, what a solo.
Amazing, yes. Loser. I mean, I love a mid-tempo, bittersweet Garcia song, and Loser, I think, is just a perfect example of that. But sonically there, I think you can really start to hear the separation between the musicians, which would become a hallmark of the Wall of Sound. You know, within the Wall of Sound, each player had their own PA. So the Wall of Sound would be basically an assemblage of six individual PAs. But I think you can really start to hear the separation there coming in early 1973. And the local Lincoln Journal sent a reporter to cover that show. And they reported that, quote, compared to a number of currently hot rock groups, the Grateful Dead sound almost calm. They do not indulge in super electronic pulsating music, but in purer sounds. I love that.
Yeah. And that was the thing, is they wanted the sound to sound as good out, you know, everywhere in the hall. They wanted the experience. I think this came from the acid test, which is a 360-degree immersive, dare I say it, sphere-like experience.
Right.
And the Dead wanted to, you know, if we only could have gotten Owsley in the sphere, I'm sure he would have had a lot of notes. But can you imagine,
sure,
in some ways, if that venue could be used for good rather than evil? And the Dead certainly,
right,
are using it for extreme good. It's
for sure
very close to what they wanted. And it, as an entertainment concept, it works, too. So it shows,
yeah,
the Dead were, of course, way ahead of their time. Well, let's get to the proverbial Wall of Sound. And I've
yeah,
let this tidbit out. You have a very, very personal connection to the Wall of Sound. Can you explain to our listeners what that is? Not just abstract.
I do. Yes, I own a piece of the Wall of Sound. I acquired this piece through a Sotheby's auction in late 2021. It's a vocal fill monitor. So not Phil Lesh, P-H-I-L, but Phil, F-I-L-L. I acquired this through an auction through Sotheby's, who partnered with Grateful Dead Productions to auction off various items from the Dead's Northern California warehouse. And this item had the lowest starting bid, and I ended up winning it. And I, in the book, I use this artifact, as I call it, as a window into telling a much bigger story about obsession and titanic human achievement. But yeah, this speaker box, it sits in my office. It's literally right next to me right now. And my mind reels when I think about all of the places and miles that it clocked, the hundreds of thousands of people who received the signals.
How many boxes of
rain
went through,
exactly,
that speaker?
Yeah. And, you know, even thinking like, you know, my parents received the sound waves flowing out of this thing. So it's, yeah, it is a piece of history, and it sits here in my office. But yeah, I use it sort of as a bookend in the story. But it's a special, very special thing to own.
Well, we're going to head now to the Alley Pally. This is the month before they retire the whole sound system. Did you know Brian Anderson, author of Loud and Clear, this definitive book on the Grateful Dead sound? The Dead movie is coming to IMAX in August.
It is.
I just,
yes,
found out about that, and it blew
yeah,
my mind, because
sure,
that's a tribute to the Wall of Sound. I mean, the audio,
absolutely,
everything about it. So if you want to, you've heard the lecture and some music, you want, if you haven't seen the Grateful Dead Zone, go to the IMAX, because
oh yeah,
and that's the movie, Brian, that made me a Deadhead. I saw Watkins,
yeah,
Glen. I
for
saw
sure
them in 74. I saw them in Winterland, a stand on the New Year shows in 77 of all years. I still wasn't,
yeah,
on the bus. I saw the Grateful,
right,
Dead movie at the Bridge Theater in San Francisco with a quad sound system. It was like this giant, you know, light bulb,
sure,
exploding, like, oh. And Garcia
yeah
is masterminded every frame of that. I got a chance to talk to an editor who worked with him on the film, and he was as hands-on as you can get in the edit bay.
Oh, for sure.
She spent a lot of time with him, and he got it just,
yeah,
exactly perfect. Well, before
that's
we go,
right,
to the Alley Pally, tell me, you know, again, tee this up. What made the Wall of Sound special? How is it different from what came before, and why hasn't it been replicated?
Sure. Well, in the words of the late, great Steve Silberman, in one of our interviews, he referred to the Wall of Sound and what made it special as cosmic democracy. And what he meant by that is that through the wall, the band and the crowd were all in the same sonic envelope, kind of traveling together. So by putting all of the gear at the musicians' backs, the band and the audience all heard the same thing. And that's a direct line back to the acid tests. And the acid tests were really the model that the Dead would follow through the Wall of Sound and really through the end of their career. So that was a big piece of it. Everyone was experiencing the same thing together. But also, the clarity, that's really what made the Wall of Sound special. It could be rip-roaring loud, but the separation of the instruments and applying, sort of point source acoustic theory, it was the clarity. So you could be out in the crowd and you could hold a conversation with someone if you wanted to. And the sound was so inoffensive that, you wouldn't be completely blasted out, although they could move enough air through it that could happen. But it was really, I think, the clarity that made the system special. All, 80 tons at its peak. That's a lot of gear. But it's really the clarity that made this thing sort of groundbreaking and kind of set the template for live sound reinforcement as we know it today.
Closing night, I think, towards the end of the Alley Pally run, London, they carted this mammoth thing overseas for just a few gigs, all fraught and troubles. Not one of the Dead's more brilliant business decisions, but what the hey. This is how they closed off their show. And the Wall of Sound is definitely cranked up to 11, hopefully all clarity intact. Well, Brian Anderson, as quote in the book says, "The wall of sound was flat out the greatest use of electricity I have ever witnessed." Not fade away is case in point. Don't you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, for one, you can tell they just didn't want to stop playing. But, you know, that was, what, the end of the third night of a three-night run. So they were cozy, and they had the system dialed in, right? Like, you can tell that the Dead's techs had so finely tuned the system to the hall's acoustics that the sound was filling only the spaces that needed covering. As Dan Healy told me, a key part of the theory of the wall of sound was to set it up so that 100% of the sound only went to 100% of the audience and nowhere else, right? And, you know, that thinking would carry on for, you know, the next 20 years of the Dead's career, really to the end, right? But wow, yeah, what a performance. Scorching.
Yeah. Well, that's about it. Brian Anderson, I want to, if you haven't perused your New York Times bestseller list, it's called Loud and Clear, The Grateful Dead's Wall of Sound and the Quest for Audio Perfection. And this has Dead Literature Perfection in it. It's a fantastic book, Brian. And
thank you
so much for joining me. Any quick last thoughts before we I bid you good night, Winterland, in February of 74?
Yes. Well, thanks so much for having me. This was a ton of fun. And yeah, you can pick up the book wherever books are sold. A total thrill to have it out there. And, you know, it's been super fun just sort of tracking the evolution of the sound here with you this afternoon. So thank you so much.
Would you please pat that piece of Phil's speaker for me right now in your office?
I am. Okay. I'm patting it right now. Yes. It says hello.
Lay down, my dear brother. Lay down and take your rest. I want to lay you on your Savior's breast. I love you, oh, but Jesus loves you the best. And I bid you good night, good night, good night. And I bid you good night,
good night,
good night,
good night.
Lay down, my dear brother, lay down and take your rest. I want you to lay your head upon your Savior's breast. I love you, oh, but Jesus loves you the best. And I bid you good night,
good night,
good night,
good night,
good night. And I bid you good night,
good night.
Ten aim for the ark, that wonderful boat.
Good night,
good night,
good night.
Before the beast was the ending of the wood. Good night,
good night,
good night, good night,
good night,
good night.
We're
walking in Jerusalem just like John.
Good night,
good night,
good night.
Lay down, my dear brother, lay down and take your rest. I want you to lay your head upon your Savior's breast. I love you, oh, but Jesus loves you the best. And I bid you good night,
good night,
good night,
good night,
good night. And I bid you good night,
good night,
good night,
good night,
good night.
Good night. See y'all later.